a couple of sheets up front. If you need one, let me know. The one is the one that I sent out by email, and the other one is an outline that we're going to look at this morning, which is an overview of the book, and hopefully we'll get through that quickly and can go into the study of Esther, because I promised that. So here we go. The book of Esther, we have no idea who wrote that book. And we could just stop right there and say, okay, let's go on. But there are people who have speculated about who wrote it, so we'll just mention those. One is Mordecai. And why do you think Mordecai might be considered as an author?
Kim? He was probably the biggest insider, who was a Jew.
Okay, all right. He was familiar with the Jewish culture, and he was also familiar with the Persian culture and the city of Susa there and the customs. All right. And there's one other thing in the book of Esther, chapter 9, if you'll look there. And verse 20, I believe this is after Mordecai had been promoted and taken Haman's place. Then Mordecai recorded these events, and he sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far. So he recorded things, wrote them down. We don't have access to those. That would be pretty nice, wouldn't it? But we don't. All right, another one is the men of the great synagogue. I had never heard that term before, but apparently it was a group in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah and may have included them. Here's something I read on a website. The institution of the Great Synagogue, or perhaps more correctly, the Great Assembly, belongs to that period of Jewish history which is still virtually a complete blank, namely the Persian period. Hence, very little is known of it with real certainty. But this would be during the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, and some believe the group is just a legendary group, but obviously others do not. All right, Nehemiah is one who has been considered a potential author. Why would Nehemiah be thought to have written it? Well, around Jerusalem. Okay. He was. All right. He was in the Persian period, wasn't he? What king did he serve? He was a cupbearer to one of the kings, Artaxerxes, which would have been after this time. All right. He would have been pretty familiar with the Persian court and customs, and he lived in Susa. Okay, it was perhaps written between 450 and 300 BC. That's a pretty wide period of time, but probably not real long after these events happened. The time of the events is said to be between Ezra 6 and Ezra 7. So let's turn to Ezra and find out what was going on with some of the other Jews at the time of Esther. So Ezra 6, verses 13 through 16. Kim?
Oh, no.
Oh, okay. All right, Ezra 6, 13 through 16. You can just...
Then Tattenai, governor of the region beyond the river, Shethar, Bosnai, and their companions diligently did according to what King Darius had sent. So the elders of the Jews built, and they prospered through the prophesying of Haggai, the prophet, and Zechariah, the son of Iddo. And they built and finished it according to the commandment of the God of Israel, and according to the command of Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes, king of Persia. Now the temple was finished on the third day of the month of Adar, which was in the sixth year of the reign of King Darius, when the children of Israel, the priests and the Levites, and the rest of the descendants of the captivity celebrated the dedication of this house of God with joy.
Okay, so they've just finished building the temple and had the dedication. Then in chapter 7, verse 1, and then skip to 6 through 8. Who's ready to read that? Verse 1, okay, Audrey.
All right, you said 7, 1, and then
6 through 8.
Now after these things, in the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Ezra, the son of Sariah, the son of Azariah, the son of Hilkiah. Ezra went up from Babylon, and he was a ready scribe in the law of Moses, which Jehovah, the God of Israel, had given. And the king granted him all his requests according to the hand of Jehovah, his God, upon him. And there went up some of the children of Israel, and of the priests, and the Levites, and the singers, and the porters, and the Nethinim, unto Jerusalem in the seventh year of Artaxerxes the king. And he came to Jerusalem in the fifth month, which was in the seventh year of the king.
All right. So the temple's been completed. Then we have the period of Esther, the story of Esther, and then Ezra and his group of exiles go back to Jerusalem. And so there's kind of a gap between 6 and 7, or maybe there's not so much of a gap as there is. We're just filling in a few details from the book of Ezra, Esther. Okay. So it was in the land of Persia. It was primarily the story of Esther in Susa, this capital city. And it was the only two books in the Old Testament were written outside the Promised Land, totally outside. Ezekiel mentions, he kind of goes back and forth in his visions. Daniel was totally in the land of exile, and so was Esther. All right. And then, I forgot to mention that one of the other considerations for the author would have been Esther. It's not as likely women did not write as commonly as men, but that's one consideration. All right, so the genre of the book has been disputed. Some believe it's totally history. It's just what happened. Others actually believe, and there are historical elements to support that. What do we have? We know about Persia, don't we? We have history about Persia. We know about Xerxes. We've read some of what happened when he was king. We know that the Jews were in exile here. And we know about Purim. And then there are others who believe that perhaps it is a fictional work. And we're going to talk about that. That may, at one point, that would have really bothered me. Don't tell me that the Bible is fiction. I worked with a man who thought all the stories in the Bible were fiction. He was a believer, but he felt like they were all fiction. And that didn't click with me. We didn't have many conversations after that. I guess I didn't want to know. I was pretty young and didn't want to know why he thought that. But some of the reasons for this, there's no mention of Esther in any historical records. Okay? There's no mention of Mordecai, Vashti, or Haman in any historical records. There is the only wife that we have a record of Xerxes. Her name was Amestris, Amestris, but it's possible that was another name for her. We just don't know. But there are no records for those four characters in the Esther story. There are some seeming discrepancies between the story of Esther and the history, and one of them talks about in Esther how Mordecai was exiled, and he would have had to have been very, very old. So we reconcile that by understanding that the Bible many times would be talking about descendants or ancestors. I mean, So it could have been that Mordecai's family was exiled, and then he was born in exile. All right, so that's one reason people don't believe it's quite historical. Some scholars have suggested that the author did not intend the book to be historical, but rather a historical novella. So we talked, some of us were talking earlier about historical fiction. I love to read historical fiction. It's based on history, but the characters, you know, it's like the TV shows. The names of these characters have been changed for the, you know, how did they say that? Yeah, for the protection of the innocent or something like that. Historical novellas were a common type of writing during this period, during the Persian period and the Hellenistic period. So, do you find that troubling, that people would believe that the story is fictional based on history?
We all look up to, so if it's not true, I'd be going down that.
And like I said, that would have bothered me. It bothered me when I first read it, and then I got to thinking, okay, what about the parables? Jesus taught in parables. They weren't true characters. They were based on human nature. They were based on historical things. That's just, and this is in no way telling you what I believe, because I believe the book of Esther, that it was probably historical. But I'm also open to, if God wanted to write, give us a historical fiction. Nikki?
The result of the whole book is a false feeling, which is real. And God to allow, if he was the creator of this feast, then he wouldn't put that in the hands of a woman and a man to be the creators of this feast.
And that is
why they would allow, God would allow the fiction book to be an initiator or a feast givers to human beings if God himself was the creator of this.
And that is one of the problems of, you know, the scholars that argue this back and forth. Well, what about Purim? It's real. Where did it come from? Okay. So, but my question would be, was God's purpose fulfilled whether or not this is real or fiction? It was. And I, for one, at this point, believe that it's history. And we don't have to have, we know, I had another coworker say one time, well, I'll believe when there's more archaeological evidence. And I thought, well, you don't even know what faith is about. We don't have to have the archaeological evidence. We have evidence of God all around us, and we have his word, and we can be grateful for that. All right, so what is the purpose of the book of Esther? I have three things written down, if you can think of. Well, one, Nikki just touched on. We know about the origin of Purim, don't we? We know about that feast and that the Jews still practice that today. So we're going to learn more about that feast later. And what was our first lesson about? The preservation of a nation. So do you think this book helps us see that? Another instance of God preserving his people for the lineage of Christ. And one of the most interesting things about the book, of course, is that there's no mention of God. But we can see the providence of God in the unseen, in the unsaid things. And that may be part of the skill of the writer. That may have been just part of the way the story is told, that it was intentional to leave God. I mean, how can you not write a story like this and say something about God? But we consider it inspired. If God had wanted himself mentioned, he would have been mentioned, but he is not. And we can look through here and see his providence over and over. And it's a wonderful story. And then the there are just few literary features of the book. This has been an interesting thing to get into, you know, to talk about. Well, I just mentioned the skillful storytelling. I never thought of books of the Bible being skillfully written. They're from God. They're breathed out from God. So, but I believe this is true with this this book. There's a plot, a sequence of events, and the way that they relate to each other. There's satire. There's irony. There's humor. So have a sense of humor when you read this. And when Haman gets in trouble, you know, of course we don't want people to have their souls lost, but the way he bumbles around is just really funny. And so make notes as you study about some of these features. There's foreshadowing. You know, you get to a part, and I would say this is more, and this is probably paradox or whatever the term is, that after you've read it once, then you learn some of these things. You know, you start to read again, you go, oh, I wonder if that means so-and-so, like when the king can't sleep. Wonder why. And how is this going to work out? What does that mean? There are paired events. Look for those. There are several I had never even thought about. But we start out with two banquets, right? Esther has two banquets. There are other pairs. So look through there as you read. There's good versus evil. We all like a good villainous story, don't we? We like the good and the evil stories. And what's going to happen in this story? Do we know? Do you know what happens at the end? Yes, we know. And even if we hadn't read it, I think we would know by the time we got partway through it that good is going to overcome. And that's a good story when good overcomes. We don't like the evil one to win at the end, do we? All right, so as we go through the quarter, consider the no mention of God. Does this mean that God's absent? Does it take away from the book's validity? Is this a weakness or a strength of the narrative? And are there any religious tones at all throughout the book? So just think about those things. Think about words that you would use to describe this story. Do you have any that you can think of that come to mind? Words that highlight? Epic, okay. It is epic. What else?
Decadent.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Persians, feasts.
All right. Okay. What else? What's that, what's part of this dome? You think of the features of this story. Well, I mentioned the good versus evil. We've got that. There's danger, isn't there?
Desperation.
Mm-hmm.
Hope.
Okay. Always hope. Always when God has a plan for bringing someone down, even his own people, his own loved nation, there's hope for that nation because there's always that remnant. Okay, the remnant is obvious in this book. Okay.
Courage.
Yes, absolutely.
The risk and the suspense created by the
risk. Right, right. Okay.
Arrogance.
Very definitely arrogance.
I also think of deliverance.
Uh-huh. Right.
So I think, like, even though God has not mentioned, like, that specific line points to God, right? Because, mm-hmm. you know, in essence, he's saying, if it doesn't happen with you, like, God will make it come.
That's exactly right. Let's see, I was going to read an excerpt, and of course, last night I had them all figured out. Okay, about the historicity part, the question about that. The name Vashti does not agree with Greek historian Herodotus, who refers to the wife of Ahasuerus as a mistress. The names of Ahasuerus, which is Xerxes, Vashti, Esther, Mordecai, and Haman, do not come across in the English translation. Instead of being the actual name of the historical person, these names were probably chosen or created by the human author to characterize the people who nonetheless did actually exist in history with other names. Well, Ahasuerus was Xerxes, but one is an English derivation of a Hebrew name which came from Persian, and Xerxes is Greek. All right. So Vashti's name is said to sound similar to the ancient Persian expression meaning beautiful woman. As such, it would have simply been a literary device used to characterize the woman otherwise known to history as a mistress. That's just one man's thought about that. All right, so, and as you go through, also make notes of historical things. You might Google them or look them up in a Bible dictionary. But I wanted to point out, I do have an outline that I'm going to send out by email, and I'll have them up here next week. But it's subject to change because we have no idea how, since we have two or three classes at the end that are sort of an open class schedule, we're going to take our time. If we don't finish today, we'll just pick up next week because we have that freedom. And that'll be wonderful that we don't have to rush through. Okay, so now we're going to get to our little worksheet. Wasn't that fun? It is. I know it was so simplified. And you may not have gotten to it, and that's okay. We're going to go through it today, and I have some other notes. So let's turn to Esther and read chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. All right. Leanne, would you read that?
Does anyone need a worksheet? I need one.
Okay. Thank you. All right.
Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this was the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the citadel, that in the third year of his reign he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. And when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all.
Okay. All right, so we're just going to go through these lines on the worksheet. And if you have a comment to make about them, I would be happy. I'd love for you to help with the discussion. So, in the first line, now it took place in the days of Xerxes or Ahasuerus. Now it took place. That's a simple little thing. We think, okay, well, why are you going to bring that out? But I read that sometimes these words were a writing formula for it meant to say that this actually took place. All right. In the days of Xerxes. So this tells us when. It doesn't tell us exactly when. We'll get down to that a little bit further, except that we do know when he reigned, don't we? Okay. Xerxes is Greek, as I pointed out. He's believed to be the same man as the one Ahasuerus. And the Xerxes who reigned, what does that tell us? He was king. All right. From India to Ethiopia. If you were here last week, we had a map, didn't we? From India, in the western India in the east, to Ethiopia, part of Africa, even part of Greece, just a little bit, Europe in the west. All right. over 127 provinces. Do you remember how many satraps there were in Daniel? 127, actually. So it sounds like between the time that we're reading of Esther and the time that Daniel, maybe it had grown just a little bit more, and there were a few more provinces. So this tells us where. It was in the Persian Empire, wasn't it? All right. In those days, King Xerxes sat on his royal throne. What does that tell us? Okay, we've already said he reigned, so we think, okay, he was reigning. But he wasn't out fighting, was he? He was home. He had been out fighting. There had been some internal risings and revolts. He had had to quell those. He had gone off to Greece and tried to expand his kingdom. Some of those efforts were not successful. So he was back home. And he was in where? The city of Susa. And it says the citadel. All right. So I have here the main city of Susa had a circumference of 6 to 7 miles, and the fortress, or the citadel, occupied an elevated site enclosed by a massive wall 2.5 miles in length and crowned by the royal palace. So you have this citadel, this fortress walled area sitting above the city, and then the palace above, just elevated above that. Susa was the former capital of ancient Elam and became one of the three capitals of the Persian kings. We noticed last week there were actually four capitals. They spent the winters in Babylon, the spring in Susa, and the summer in Ecbatana. Susa was both the name of the city and the name of the royal fortress. It was, and the fortress, they say again, was a rectangular platform 72 feet above the general level of the city, surrounded by a huge wall 2.5 miles long. So that tells you a little bit. There are pictures or diagrams of what they think it looked like and some pictures of ruins that you can see online. All right, so in the third year of his reign, and we know that he reigned from 486 to 465 B.C., he gave a banquet. All right, so what kind of king is he that he gives a banquet? He likes to entertain, right? Pleasure, and we know from the rest, who was at this one? The military, yeah, the people that waited on him, the nobles and princes of his provinces. So, officials throughout the empire were there. It was a big to-do.
Which means it would have been at a time of peace because they're not out at battle.
Right. That's a good point. That's right. And like we said, he had put down these revolts. He came back home and the timing of this banquet corresponds well to the Great War Council of 483 BC, held to plan the next invasion of Greece. The military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes or members of the royal family, and the nobles of the provinces were present. The enormous size of the Persian Empire, from modern Pakistan in the east to modern Turkey in the west, included many nationalities with different languages, ethnic origins, and religions. It took some time after his father's death for Ahasuerus to secure the throne against his rivals and quell the uprisings in Egypt and Babylon. Then he devoted himself to finishing the fortress of Susa that his father Darius I had begun. With those tasks completed, the king was ready to apply himself to empire building. As a result, here we see him rallying support for his military campaign against Greece. So it very likely that this was a planning session as well as just having a time of peace and enjoying that feasting with all of the officials. Okay, so he displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty. This was a time when he could feel secure in that, wasn't it? During a peaceful time? For how long?
6 months.
Half a year. Ready for the next shift?
That's what I thought. 80 days. But you know, and then, but when those days were over, he gave another banquet for 7 days.
Oh yeah,
he wasn't done.
No,
he still wanted to party.
Yeah,
yeah.
And here's what this commentary says about that. Feasting for 180 days seems so absurd to some that they challenge the historical accuracy of the Book of Esther. But Ahasuerus was bringing nobles, officials, and military leaders from all over his vast kingdom, preparing them for the war effort against Greece. Having them all come to Susa at one time was probably not wise either logistically or militarily. Yeah, I mean, you don't want everybody there and nobody out
right.
in the provinces, right?
All the military officers are tied up.
Yeah. Yeah, that would not be good. More than likely, they were brought in from each of the provinces in ships. So, that explains some of that.
The same thing with the second banquet. It took only 7 days and he served all the people of that city.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way you could bring all the people in one place at the
right.
same time. So, they had to take shifts. That's why this was a political movie.
It
is.
It is.
Him entertaining himself.
Right. Even though there was a lot of that going on.
Yeah.
But it was for political reasons.
Yeah. You want to unite the whole empire and get them to know each other and plan.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, he had to attend to the little people. They were just witnesses.
Yeah.
So I'm going to get you happy one way or another.
So the huge ones, the first one's like this huge military staff meeting or something like that. And campaign plan. All right. So after, here we go into the second banquet. Let's read chapter 1, verses 5 through 8. You have it? Go ahead and read it.
I have it. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people from the least to the greatest who were in the citadel of Susa. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen and purple material, to silver rings on marble pillars. There were counters of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other, and the royal wine was abundant, in keeping with the king's liberality. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink in his own way, for the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished.
All right. So, we have the second banquet, much, much shorter, but can you imagine the beauty of that? In the garden, for one thing, or the courtyard, so it sounds like it was an outdoor thing, or at least open-air kind of a place, which reminds me, is anybody interested in doing a report on the gardens of Persia? That was you. Good. All right. Can you do that next week? Will you be here next week?
Next week is back. Can we push it off?
Yeah.
A week or two because I'm going to Ohio.
That's fine. That's one thing we can be flexible about. We can go into another part and then say, let's go back and talk about the gardens.
A week.
Okay.
So 2 weeks from today,
sure. All right. Sounds good. So that would be October the 18th. Or 19th, yeah. Okay. So, the...
All the people who were present in the citadel. I wonder how many... Did you read anything about how many there were?
No, I didn't see anything about how many. But I imagine they were coming and going to. It's probably like a big open house. You know?
Yeah.
But I was thinking with those curtains, you know, the drapes and things, the violet and the linen. It's not your mother's shower curtain, is it, that got hung up there? That's what I'd have to put. Oh, well, the sun's kind of bright. Let's hang up a shower curtain. Nikki.
You mentioned the beds, and I remember Romania has been conquered by Romans. 105. So they had pictures of these Romans the way they were lunching. They have these beds that they were not eating on the table with a chair. They were lunching on the bed
right.
and eating for hours. So their dinners or lunches were taking for hours, lunching, laying uh-huh. on the bed. So the fact that they mentioned beds in here
yeah.
reminds me of those traditions back then.
Yeah.
Well, not just sitting at the table like you do.
I'm thinking it sounds really good, Carly.
No, you're reclining.
So
no.
Seating great.
No, well, you love those great.
Yeah. Well, you know, even in Jesus' time, it says they reclined at a meal. You know, that was. We have a hard time imagining that, but. Right.
It was. More of a
it. Yeah, maybe their legs out to one side or something. I don't know how.
Your dirty feet that have been walking in the street away from the table.
Okay. Maybe so. So, I'm thinking the hangings were not only decorations, they were probably protect from the sun. And it was Susa. I don't know what the springtime weather, but I read that in the summer, even the reptiles would die crossing something that was so hot. So every detail was beautiful.
Ask people who have been over there, the people who have been to
Okay.
Well, the hell there. Well, but it's hot in the summer, so
yes. Yeah, yeah. I look sometimes for the soldiers that I support. Sometimes I'll look and see. We cannot send chocolate between April and October. And sometimes I'll look to see what the temperature is at that time of year, you know. So, all right. So they had these couches of gold and silver, and the pavement just sounded gorgeous with the mosaics and the different stones. Mother of Pearl, can you imagine walking on Mother of Pearl? That is just so beautiful. Well, let me read. Okay. All right.
It was just very colorful.
Oh, yeah.
And like it said, mosaic. It was just like, we got more time walking on it.
Oh. I'd be in my slippers for sure. Okay, so the second banquet. This event would have further consolidated support for the king and his campaign among all his subjects. No one witnessing such staggering exhibits of wealth and luxury could have been in doubt of his might and authority. The world belonged to him and him alone. The banquet was held in the enclosed court of the king's palace. The court of the king was laid out with beautiful gardens containing various fruits and flowers. Different trees like the palm, cypress, olive, and pomegranate were also probably planted there. Sometimes the court was paved with beautiful marble with a fountain in the center. And then next, the dazzling luxury of the Persian palace is emphasized. Blue and white is mentioned, and those were the royal colors, and we read later on when Mordecai is, I know it's coming on, Alzheimer's coming, can't think of my words. He was honored. He was dressed in blue and white, and it says the royal colors, so that the king has decorated in royal colors.
Is this a porphyry? Is this the red color?
Yes. That's what I read. It was like a burgundy bronzy color, and it had finer crystal, maybe quartz and some other crystal things in it. Yeah, that's what I found.
Right.
Okay. That was a Wikipedia article, I believe. Okay. And then on the drinking out of all these berries, I said not one vessel was the same. I love that. I like having all kinds of different things. Yeah.
They didn't go down and buy from the store.
A set. Yeah. Or this was handed down from, you know, Darius the First or something. And it says that each person could drink according to his desire. There was no compulsion. Let me read you something. By Persian law, each guest had to drink every time the king drank. But this time, they were allowed to drink as they pleased. Ahasuerus waived this edict for those unable to keep up with him. Well, I don't know about that, but anyway, he waived it, which indicates that he was some kind of drinker. The author makes a point of the many times the king drinks in this story. Indeed, the Hebrew word for banquet is related to the word for to drink. So we know that there was lots of that going on, and his heart was merry by the end.
Down in verse 10, he was in high spirits from wine.
All right, and then just real briefly, verse 9. Queen Vashti in verse 9. So here's the banquet she gives. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. I thought it was interesting that they wanted to make a point. This was the king's palace. So here's a blurb about the women. The women did not have their feast in the same room with the men. This separation was an ancient custom. So that's all I read about that. I do need someone to do a report about the women of that time. And if you need some sources, I have at least one that's pretty good. And all you have to do is give us some bullet points. It doesn't have to be. In fact, I don't want it to be a real long report. Just like a few things that might highlight their customs, how they were esteemed in that period of time. So.
Is that still the custom today?
I don't know.
In India, they like in a restaurant, you're separated.
In a restaurant, you are?
Yes.
Okay. Interesting.
In Saudi Arabia.
Like a wedding band.
So you'll go in together, but the...
Or
yeah,
there's
men here,
yeah,
or the women.
Right.
Okay.
At least that was 20 some years ago. I imagine it's changed much.
All right. Well, next week, we're just going to do the rest of that chapter, 10 through 22. And like I said, the outline may change from week to week. We'll just see how much we get through. And if somebody can do a report on the women, that would be great. Sarah? Okay, great. Thank you. If you're going to be here, that would be wonderful. And, oh, I meant to mention that, of course, Judy Weatherby and her family are in the Poconos, but Delia Effie, our new member, she and Juliet, who visited her recently, they're in a conference in Rio de Janeiro.